Hello, welcome to Books on the Go, a podcast where we talk about our book of the week. I'm Anna Bailey-Karras and I'm here with Annie Waters. Hi, Annie.
Hi.
And this week we've been reading The Years by Annie Ernaux, translated by Alison L. Strayer. But first, on to book news. And there's not enormous amounts of news. We're having a little break from the awards season. with one exception, we thought we'd run through the shortlist for the Man Booker International Prize, which is being announced on the 21st of May. So if I'm organised, you'll be listening to this around about the time it's being announced.
Hooray.
Or just before. If I can get this up and running. The reason we thought we'd mention it is because The Years is in the shortlist for that prize. So, and this is a prize that's awarded to a book in translation, and it's £50,000, is that right? Mm. And the prize money is split between the author and the translator. And I saw a nice quote this week actually by George Steiner, which is, "Without translation, we would be living in provinces bordering on silence." Mm. So just a reminder of how important it is to have translators and to have access to books written in other languages if, like me, you can only read in one. So on the shortlist is Celestial Bodies by Jocker Al-Harthy and translated by Marilyn Booth from Arabic, and The Years by Annie Ernaux, translated by Alison L. Strayer. The Pine Islands by Marion Poschmann, translated by Jen Kaleya from the German. Drive Your Plough Over the Bones of the Dead by Olga Tokarczuk, translated by from the Polish by Antonia Lloyd-Jones.
Isn't that a great title?
It's a I think that's the winner of the best title.
Sure.
And Olga Tokarczuk won it last year for Flights.
Yeah.
I didn't quite get into that, but that was an interesting book. But I could tell she was a wonderful writer, but the format of the book and the it was quite jumping about, so I couldn't quite engage and get into it as a story, but that's, you know, that's just me
and me. And
but apparently Drive Your Plough Over the Bones of the Dead is better.
Okay. Well, more of a complete novel perhaps,
maybe,
than a travel memoir / novel.
Yeah, so it could be worth checking that one out. The Shape of the Ruins by Juan Gabriel Vasquez, translated from the Spanish. He's Colombian, but translated from the Spanish by Anne McLean. And The Remainder by Alia Trabuco Zeran, who's Chilean, and translated from the Spanish by Sophie Hughes. So,
yes, well, knowing very little about most of those books, it's very hard to pick a winner.
Yes.
I know the Pine Islands has a beautiful cover and has only just been released here in Australia, so I'd be interested to read that one.
Yeah.
And my partner's reading The Shape of the Ruins at the moment, and he, Juan Gabriel Vasquez is one of his absolute favourite writers. So
I love
him
too.
I think he could be a contender. But, I mean, who knows? We'll find out on Tuesday.
I'd be quite keen to read The Shape of the Ruins, but and the I love the cover of the Pine Islands. Stay tuned for that one. And then just the we thought we should catch up on the top 10 bestsellers. Is there anything new, Annie? What's happening?
I mean, some more of the same. At the top we have Boy Swallows Universe by Trent Dalton.
Oh, good.
I suspect on the back of his multiple award-winning run that he's had for the past few weeks.
Yeah.
Then we've got Ian McEwan's new one, Machines Like Me. We've got The Bad Guys. Then the Stella Prize winner, The Erratics by that we read several weeks ago.
Wow, that's good.
In at number four and is selling really, really well, which is great. I think especially over Mother's Day, that was a really good Mother's Day gift.
An interesting Mother's Day gift, actually.
Well,
I posted about it on Mother's Day because I think that's roughly when we uploaded our episode about that one, and I was thinking, well, it's an odd Mother's Day choice, but also in some ways quite apt. So.
Well, yes, and if you had even a passing to decent relationship with your mother, it would probably reaffirm that it could be so much worse.
Yeah, so, that's right.
So that's in at number four. Number five is No Friend But the Mountains by Behrouz Bachani, also on the back of his multiple
awards. Oh, that's good, actually. Good to see that selling well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think especially with the election coming up and people are feeling like this is a book we need to read. The pulse that I'm getting.
Well, Amanda and I are reading that for the podcast.
Oh,
so that's coming up soon. Yeah.
Then there's Diary of an Awesome Friendly Kid by Jeff Kinney.
Of course.
Of course, Dark Emu by Bruce Pascoe. Which interestingly, he's just released yesterday a new book for younger readers, Dark Emu, A Truer History, which is kind of a, I guess, for six and up, a kind of very schooly type resource that is a reduced version of his adult book, which looks great. It's really well produced.
I've got Dark Emu, so I'll have to check out the younger one.
Yeah. Then Australian Day by Stan Grant, Eleanor Oliphant is completely fine, and the CSIRO Protein Plus book, which I'm sure everyone is hanging out.
How random. Okay.
Get their hands on. Those CSIRO books go like the clackers.
Yeah. It's great. Interesting. People really trust their recommendations. Well, there you go. And on to our book of the week. So we've been reading The Years by Annie Ernaux, translated by Alison L. Strayer. And as I mentioned, it is good to mention the translator, and they, in this Man Booker International Prize, they do get rewarded because they bring a lot to the reading experience, I think, if you have a good translation. Annie Ernaux was born in 1940 in Normandy. She's a French writer, and some of her books, A Man's Place and A Woman's Story, are two that have been mentioned as contemporary classics, and they were New York Times notable books. And she's written about things like her marriage, Alzheimer's, breast cancer. So she draws very much from her own experiences, and her writing has been quite autobiographical. Which, have you read other ones, Annie?
I've read A Woman's Story, which is about her mother and her descent into Alzheimer's.
Yes.
I studied it at university in France. And so she kind of invented this autofiction style, which, I guess blurs the line between memoir and fiction.
Well, I'm giving Annie a look at the moment.
Quite a pointed look.
We will have to talk about the form of the book and what, I mean, not that it matters in one sense what you call it, but in the context of the Man Booker International shortlisting, that is an issue because that's a prize that's awarded to a work of fiction. So I have some issues there, but it's not the be all and end all about the work, but she certainly draws from, her autobiographical experiences. So The Years, what is it? It's been described as a historical memoir, and it's also been described as a creative autobiography. And the term apparently that Ernaux herself coined is autosociobiography. So that could be a sort of catch-all. It was actually published in 2008 in France, which is interesting. We might talk about, how it reads now, because we're now reading it in 2019, because I think it was only translated more recently. It won the Prix Renaudot in 2008 in France, and it won the Premio Strega in Italy in 2016. As I mentioned, it's been shortlisted for the Man Booker International Prize. It's been compared also with In Search of Lost Time by Marcel Proust, and that's because it's preoccupied with memory and the idea of time and the passage of time. And Annie Ernaux herself has said that the main character in the book is time. So it's, to me, it's a memoir, but however, we can talk about how we would describe it. But she talks about herself in the third person and then broadens it out to give impressions of her generation and of what was happening in France at various times in her life. And each sort of section, she'll start with a photo, and in one case I think it's some video footage, but generally a photograph, and she'll say the girl is standing on the beach, for example, and it's her, but she talks about herself in the third person. And then she'll say, she had just been on holidays, or she was doing this, or she was doing that, and then she'll branch out into a wider social history, really, and talk about we. So, for example, she'll say, we did our homework at the table while we were listening to the radio, and we had time to desire things, and we would collect little plastic toys from the coffee packets or things like that. So she gives you a sense of what it was like to be a child in the 1940s. or the 1950s, for example, by talking about we, but you understand that it's her generation. She doesn't necessarily share all of the views that we had at the time or that all the, you know, activities and things that we did. She's meaning that in a wider sense.
But also quite a narrow sense, I thought, because we only refers to her little provincial kind of upbringing.
At that point.
At that point, but then it does broaden.
She moves to Paris eventually.
She moves to Paris, but it kind of stays with that kind of upward moving middle class white woman
Paris.
Which I think is, she recognises that's not a flaw of the book, but I think that's who the we that she's talking about is, that kind of bourgeois developing consciousness in France.
Yes, and sometimes she's quite satirical about that too. So she'll say, much to everyone's relief, a job was found for the homeless. They could now sell magazines or newspapers and so on. And you can tell that she's not, that's not a sentiment that she has, but that's the way that it's been communicated and the way that perhaps sort of poking fun at it in a way, but in a very dry tone. So yes, it's certainly an unsentimental sort of memoir and not deeply personal in that way. What you get by the end of it is a sense of France over time. So you go from the 1940s through to 2008 or thereabouts, the early 2000s, which she says we never called the noughties. And so you start with things like, as a teen girl, being incredibly virtuous or being told to be very virtuous, and the double standards around all of that for girls and young women, and then the absolute fear over pregnancy, the lack of birth control, all of that sort of era. And then obviously that changes. Things become more permissive by the time she has children and they become teenagers. It's quite a different environment. And you read about the marches of 1968 and then there's another uprising in 1981 that she talks about, and the various sort of changes of government. So you sort of come to the, you know, the 1990s and the 2000s, and there's been quite enormous changes from when, you know, you started the book. So you get a sort of a long view, I suppose, of history, but history from, as you say, a particular point of view. But she does try to give a broader sense. What did you think, Annie? So Annie had recommended this because you'd obviously enjoyed A Woman's Story. So how did you find the years?
It took me a little while to get into. I think definitely her childhood sections, I felt, well, the voice is quite alienating. So the tone is very removed. It's very detached.
Yes.
And I found that quite difficult. And it's, she alternates between sections of prose and kind of just snippets of memories, which very much did remind me of Proust, and I did not enjoy that book necessarily.
Right. See, I haven't read Proust, so not that that will surprise anyone. Another book that...
Put it on the pile or don't.
That I've never quite got around to reading. But so I was interested, if you've read it, how that does compare.
The Proust is much more inward looking and much more kind of navel gazing.
Yes. But didn't he write that just in his bedroom, like he'd never left his house or something?
Months,
so
years.
That is quite inward.
Whereas this kind of turns that, really inverts that gaze, and you don't get much of the internal life. It's almost like the author is searching for who she was at that point in time and trying to tell it to herself.
Yeah.
And so I came to really enjoy it, especially by the time she was a teenager and into her kind of 30s. I really related to her and felt a sense of that kind of being swept along on the passage of time, and you make these decisions that you recognise are governed by overarching mores, that, you know, you get married, you buy a house, you have kids, get a dog, blah, 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 but that you as a person, as an individual, don't necessarily click with or gel with, but it just seems to be the done thing.
Well, certainly in her time when she was about 17, 18, 19, it was very much the done thing, to the point where she didn't have much choice almost compared to an 18-year-old today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really enjoyed that kind of discussion, quite a frank discussion about, you know, how much sex was going on before marriage, even though no one talked about it and no one wanted to know about it, especially not the parents or the church. And if you did have to go get an abortion, you went off to either Switzerland if you were very wealthy, or to the kind of house around the corner where unspeakable things went on.
Well, and how dangerous that was.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And with things that are going on in the US at the
quite
moment.
Quite topical this, really this week, timely. Unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think at what point in the 70s, at some point, there's a list in the newspaper of 384 women who've come out and said, we did this.
Mm.
And she feels overwhelmed with this sense of, I should add my name to this list. I did this. I was there.
Yeah.
And I think that, for me, is what the book is about, of that matching of personal history and capital H history and trying to slot yourself into this big wide stream of events that happens, while all the while you're kind of carrying on your little your journey with your chosen person or people and trying to find a place that you fit.
Yeah,
so I came to really love it.
Yeah.
And it's a book that has stayed with me. And I underlined it, which I do very rarely. The last book I underlined was Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And I just kept
being been underlining.
Overwhelmed by these sentences and these, she's just, I felt like I was meeting this great mind.
Yes.
And I was overwhelmed at points. So I really came to love it. But how about you?
Wow. So interesting about the underlining, and there's a whole tangent we could go down about do you mark your books. There's a wonderful video on YouTube. There's a channel, Books by Lanes, I think it is, L-E-Y-N-E-S, and she is fabulous, and she does a whole video about why I mark up my books.
Mm-hmm.
And what she says is, because I can't do it. I'm terrible. I just have to, I like them to be pristine. But she says she'll read a book and then 5 years later she'll go back and she'll have no memory of what she thought of it or even what it was about. Whereas if she marks it up, it becomes almost a record of herself at that age.
Mm.
Because books that maybe you read when you're 18, if you put your comments in the margins and you go back to it when you're 30 or whatever, it's actually almost it's a
conversation.
It's a conversation, and you might read it differently when you're older, but at least you can go back to the person you were and the impressions you had, and you remember remember the experience of reading it much more than if it's just a pristine copy in the library
that,
you know, doesn't actually mean anything unless you reread the whole thing.
Well, I very rarely write annotations because I just can't. I mean, I'm not a diarist. I'm an editor to the point of self-effacement. So I very rarely write anything. I can't add anything, but I just want to remember it to myself. And I think the underlining for me is, I don't know, adding your own emphasis. Like if you're a journalist and you have a quote from someone.
Lots of people do it.
Yeah.
Lots of people do it.
It's very rare that I feel moved to do that.
Mm.
And so then I often have to go back to the start and then start again and underline all the bits there that I wanted to underline but didn't have the impetus quite to.
How interesting. Well, so moving back, we better
talk about the book rather than my copy of the book.
But I'll pick up on your last point, Annie, about it's like meeting a great mind. And that was my overall impression, and I did like you, I came to love it, was that it's like when you're – at the moment we're in an election week and in any given week there are things happening on the news to do with politics or other things. And it's like, you know, when you have that friend who's a bit more politically engaged and educated than you are and a bit more switched on with what's happening, and you want to ring them up and say, what did you think about this? Because that'll give you, rather than relying on a newspaper or a social media feed, you want a trusted friend's opinion.
Yeah, but almost like
about
a springboard
stuff.
To hear what they think, and then you can kind of figure out what you think reflexively.
Yeah. I'm a bit lazy like that. And so I found it was like that, and it would have been, of course, that would have had even more resonance if I was more familiar with French politics or indeed if I lived in France because I see her as someone who you sort of want her opinion on things and her take on it rather than what the media gives you necessarily.
She seems to me like a French Helen Garner or something, someone like that. Just takes time, is very considered, and then delivers kind of the final take
and
that you're like, okay, yep, I'm happy to
and
just.
And sees things quite clearly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no, I think she's certainly iconic in France. She's,
yeah, you can kind of see why though, because it is a very French book, and I think, I mean, I had to look up lots of references and there were lots that I didn't bother to probably should have. And I have lived in France and studied French and kind of have a background in French history. So I know some of these events, but the specifics of it that she's talking about, and especially the products and things that were coming through, because it's quite, I think she's charting idiosyncratic. The rise. Yeah. In a way, she's charting the rise of consumerism and celebrity and all of these kind of modern things making their way into France as they did around the world.
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it, to take a step back and see that those changes.
Yeah, and the way that she kind of presents it, she's got these vignettes that repeat. So there's the dinner table vignette where, you know, in the first
Christmas lunch and things like that.
In the first section, the adults are all talking about the war, and the war is either still going or just finished. And so they're kind of singing songs of victory and telling themselves their own heroics and repeating the atrocities to themselves and kind of telling themselves their history so that they can understand it and believe it. And then as time goes on, that gets replaced by the people who have televisions start talking about the people who are on television, and everyone else kind of looks about like, who cares about these people? And then, you know, I think there's a line where she says, and then I got a television, and it's like that's the completion of her fitting into the social model.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And like all the pieces kind of fit into place.
She's not it's the rebel anymore. Eerie, she becomes the adult, and then she becomes a grandmother. Mm. So then you have the Christmas lunch where, you know, she's
passé,
become dependent on that routine that she used to almost rebel against, I think. At the beginning, like you, I was finding it annoying, and until I got the hang of the structure, I suppose. So the way that she'll have a photo and then she'll talk about herself at that time in the third person, but you know that's what it is, and then she'll broaden it out. Once I got the hang of that's what she was doing, I was able to just relax and enjoy it a bit more. But at first when she had, you know, there's a photo of a girl on the beach and she's doing this and she's doing that, I was getting really, well, we know it's you, so why are you talking about yourself in the third person as if it's some girl when it's clearly you? And just say, I was on the beach, this is a photo of me, I'm going to, you know, because it felt as if she was, as you say, distancing you from the story or distancing herself at first. And then I came to understand when you read more into it why she's done it that way, because, well, I don't know why exactly.
Yeah,
but
I don't know. I think she sees those selves as past, and they're not who she is now. And so she is kind of reflecting back, and I think each of those photographs she's trying to get into the head of that girl that is not someone that she is anymore. And she keeps saying that 20-year-old couldn't imagine what she was going to be like at 45. She might as well die at 52. That seems perfectly reasonable to her. And then by the time she hits 50, she thinks, no, I've become quite attached to this blood sloshing around in my body, and I don't want that to end.
Yeah.
And I think charts the course that we all go through of, you know, the impetuousness of youth and then that kind of infallibility of being 25 and thinking that you can rule the world, and then, well, I haven't reached the 50-year-old point yet.
The way your state of mind changes and the way you view age definitely changes.
And I think she's saying that the body that you're in and the mind that was in that body is changed by time, and that you can't get back to that.
You can't get it back.
No matter how much you try. Like, I think she's teaching a class of some young people. She ends up becoming a teacher. And one of them asks her, what were you like at 16? What did you want for yourself? And she says, oh, that'd take me an hour to get back to that point. And the children laugh. But she's like, no, I would have to go back and read my diaries and listen to the music that I was listening to at that point and reread the things that I was reading and reimmerse myself in that time to even try and
even
understand who I was.
Approximate it, but memories, you never can.
Yeah, memory's not enough for her, which I...
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah. No, I certainly did get over that initial trouble that I had with it, and I think I warmed to her, and it just made more sense as I went on. I think you've put it more articulately. But anyway, I got into the hang of it, and I very much enjoyed it then, and just enjoyed, having that bird's eye view over time and how things were changing and all the things that she picks up on, as you say, with vignettes that you start to see themes and threads emerging. And so I really liked it. So again, by the end, very much enjoyed it. And I liked the way she draws out the sort of movement towards from being very, if not social, at least interactive amongst your community. So going to the shops, for example, you'd have to go to about 5 different shops to get your need, you know, your groceries for the week, and then that becomes one supermarket.
The hypermarché.
That's right. And it becomes less personal. And in the same way with music, you'd end up At one point, we have a Walkman now, you know, so we can all have music inside our bodies or something. Mm. We all can go into the music. And I mean, now, of course, with smartphones, which I think by the time she's writing, they certainly have mobile phones. Mm. And then you can see the progression, computers, but even television, when she says we now had, the television came into the home. So the dream of having watching a movie inside your own home could be realised. So you start to understand then people are not going as much. They don't have to go to the cinema.
Yeah. And the point that was really poignant there was that she then said if it was inclement on Sunday, you could watch the mass on your TV screen. And
yes.
So you just take the whole point of church away, surely, yeah. Which so is less communing with...
Yeah, so things like going to church. So if you go back to the 40s or the 50s, and you can imagine in a typical week you'd go to about 5 or 7 or 10 different shops, you'd go or a market, you'd go to church, obviously you have school where no one has mobile phones or anything. So imagine how much interaction you have just in incidental ways with various people in your community, and then jump forward to the 1990s and beyond, and you just get a sense. And again, she doesn't, it's not like an essay where she's going to spell this out for you, but you have a sense of how things have changed in terms of it's become more inward and more isolated.
And whether that is in fact progress or whether modernity is kind of challenging some of the ways.
And she has a very wry tone about all of that. So she'll say things like the miracle of, you know, the microwave or something. But, you don't know if she really thinks it's a good thing. But she's not anti-progress, but she...
I think she's sceptical.
She's got a healthy scepticism, which I liked. And she's also looking at it from the point of view of women's rights. Mm. And we've touched on that a little bit. But I thought that was interesting. And she just sort of sees... I didn't get the impression that she was a huge activist, but at the same time she does chart the course of, you know, feminism, and I suppose that move from being very active to then a complacency about it, and that depresses her a little bit. And it's interesting because she's written this, well, it was published in 2008, and at a time where I think she's still viewing young women as reasonably complacent. Mm. And then since then things have changed a bit, I think.
Yeah, but obviously.
Yeah.
As it always does. I mean, this is the kind of book that you think, how do you know when to stop? When can you ever put the pen down?
Yeah, that's right.
Because I think when she's in her 40s, because that's the other thing that this book does, it's during the course of the book, the character, Annie, is also imagining herself writing this book and thinking that she has this book in her. And so it's kind of a gestational period for the book within the book, which is pretty meta. But yeah, I think when she's in her 40s, she imagines, and she's just left her husband and is getting rid of all her possessions, and I think her children are
Spoiler alert. Sorry.
No, this book doesn't feel like one where spoilers apply. Sorry. No. She and her husband have a very long and happy marriage together. You choose what ending you like. But she imagines the book ending there, and that she's kind of, the trajectory fits. It's neat that, you know, she was a child, she had nothing. She became an adult, she had everything. Now she's got nothing again and she's quite happy.
Mm.
But it doesn't end there. It goes on for another 20 years or so. And
she meets a young man.
Mm-hmm. Several.
Yeah. So, no, I really liked that, and it gives you so much to think about, and the writing is beautiful. I thought the translation was managed really well, because I think as best I can tell, her writing's quite idiosyncratic as well, in terms of the changes in tone.
And tense. Which in French, I think, signifies a lot more. English, I think, takes a lot away from that. So there's a translator's note at the end. Yeah, I think Annie Ernaux's shifting a lot between tense and tone and perspective, which for a French reader I think would just boggle one's mind, but in a good way. Yeah, it's interesting the difference between languages. You can do things in one language that you can't do in another. Well, you can make jokes in one language that don't land in another. I imagine this book is very funny in French.
Yeah.
I think some of that comes across. I think it does have a wry kind of wit to it.
Yeah.
But I imagine there's lots of double entendre, lots of wordplay. You miss and you can't try and translate, otherwise it becomes clunky. You've just got to work with what you've got.
Yeah, it can be, I think, quite a creative act, translating.
Absolutely.
Now, Annie, so is this a work of fiction?
Well, no, I don't think so. But I was never reading it as that. So I think
no, but then how does it get shortlisted? I think a lot of people who've said, "Oh, it does. It's not really fiction, but I'm so happy that it's on the shortlist because it's a work of the quality that deserves to be in the running for a prize."
Well, it sounds like she doesn't even put it into the fiction category.
No, and it won a prize for, I think one of the prizes I mentioned, I don't know which one, maybe the Italian one, was a prize for nonfiction.
Yeah, which it does blur the lines.
And how?
Well, I think because if she's imagining who she was at those times.
In the third person.
Well, I guess it's like that. Have you read that Dave Eggers book, Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius?
Oh, yes. I've heard of it.
He calls that fiction. It's based on his life and is exactly what happened in his life. But he calls it fiction because there's no way that we can ever recreate the conversations that we had, or it's only his memory that he's relying on for those things.
Mm.
So I think in that definition, this probably falls into a similar territory, even though she is relying on lots of things that, you know, history, the big H history that did happen. But I guess, I don't know. So no, I think it's not fiction.
I don't know why I'm making
a case for it being fiction. I just like the Man Booker and I don't want them to be wrong. But I think you can make that case.
Well, I'm just intrigued. I'm not anti it winning all the prizes. Mm. I love and the translation itself being recognised, I think, is really important. And so I'm all in full support of the book, but I'm just curious more than anything else as to what went, how the judges
made the call.
Yeah.
But wasn't that and the whether, case with one that you and Amanda read several?
Whether the judges, yes, it was. Mm. Whether the judges thought it was fiction or whether they're saying to themselves, well, it isn't really, but it's so
good enough.
We just want it to be in the shortlist. In fact, though, Flights was a bit like Essays. That was interesting. That wasn't.
That did have a fictional element, though.
Had short stories running through it and things like that. So, no, Amanda and I read David Saloy, All That Man Is, which won or was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. It must have.
It didn't win.
It didn't win, no. And that was a collection of short stories.
Oh, and it's for a
It was not
novel.
A novel. Mm. I'm firmly of that view. But the publishers called it a novel, and the cynical view was that the publishers marketed it as a novel so that it could be in the running for
sell more prizes. Because short stories just don't sell.
That's true, yeah.
Sadly.
So there you go. Mm. But this one I don't think has even been marketed. I don't know.
That's interesting, isn't it? We'd have to send them an angry email. I'm sure they've had a couple.
I was curious when I went into it.
Yeah, because did you go in with that preconception?
Well, I went in
thinking it was a novel? Or?
Yeah, thinking that it was a novel, or at least that it was sort of an autobiographical novel.
Yeah.
But it read to me very much like a memoir, like a slightly strange memoir. Mm. I just had to sort of get over that after the first, I don't know, chapter or so. Mm. I just had to sort of move on from that. From that was a distraction more than anything else. Mm. But either way, I thought a really strong work, really interesting, and it would repay rereading.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's been described as her magnus opus, so I think that's quite fitting.
Yeah.
Yes. So that's The Years by Annie Ernaux, translated by
Alison L. Strayer.
And next week, Amanda and I are reading At Dusk by Hwang Sok-yong, translated by Sora Kim Russell. That's why I just had to pause there because I've got so many books in translation this
isn't
week.
Isn't it Books in Translation Month?
Asian and Pacific Islander Heritage Month.
Oh, okay.
And so a lot of people are doing an Asian readathon or following the celebration, API celebration hashtag on Instagram. And is it Books in Translation Month? It could be.
I'm not sure. You know the months better than I do.
In August they celebrate Women in Translation.
Okay.
So for any of you who are intrigued to read The Years but not sure when you'll get to it, you could do
put
that
in your calendar
August.
For August.
Yeah, I don't know what other month it is. There are always so many. It's like the World Day of, like, Saturday's World Whiskey Day.
And
there's a day for there's a day or a month for everything, I think. And so we'll be reading At Dusk next week. And in the meantime, you can follow us on Facebook at Books on the Go and email us at booksonthegopodcast@gmail.com. And I am on Instagram, Litzy, and Twitter at A. Bailey Karras. And Annie?
I'm on Instagram, Litzy, and Twitter at Mr_Annie.
Very good. And we'll see you next week. Bye for now.
Thanks. Bye.